Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. It's my pleasure to welcome our sold-out crowd here in San Francisco and the online and radio audiences that will be listening later. Tonight's speaker is David Kurtzer, the author of The Pope and Mussolini, and also a professor at Brown University. And what a great insight, great research into the details behind the dance that was done by the Pope and Mussolini as they both wanted more power. Thank you very much, David.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here at the Commonwealth Club, and I appreciate all of you crowding in the room. I'm telling the story, a story of two men who had a major impact on the course of the 20th century, men who had much that made them different, but also, curiously and perhaps unexpectedly, some things that they had in common. What I'd like to do as a way of setting the scene is begin tonight the way I begin my book, with a prologue that actually comes from the end of my story, or near the end. It's a scene that takes place at the beginning of 1939. 1939 would be a fateful year, the year in which the terrible World War II would begin with Nazi troops marching into Poland later in the year. But I'm going to begin with a story from the first couple of months of the year. It's late January 1939. Pope Pius XI is now elderly. He's ailing. And he is sitting at his desk in his study trying to write a speech, the most important speech of his career, of his life as a pope. He knows the end is near. He doesn't have much time to live. He begs God that he can live long enough to give this speech. For years, the pope had been in good health. And I have a picture here I'll show of Pope Pius XI in his later years. He had, early on, been known as the Mountaineer Pope. He, as a young priest, had climbed 100 alpine peaks, very robust, a very demanding leader. The men knew around him knew he had to know every detail. He had to make every important decision. But that was earlier on. Now he was plagued by a variety of ills. His legs throbbed at night with his varicose veins. He had circulatory problems. He had difficulty breathing due to his asthma. And yet, when he would lie awake at night, what bothered him most was that he thought something had gone terribly wrong. In the daytime in his office, the office of the Pope overlooks St. Peter's Square on the third floor, with three large windows that during the day light would stream in through. But now as he sat trying to write out the remarks for this fateful speech, it's nighttime, so there was just a little lamp on his desk casting a yellow glow on these sheets. He thought he is God's vicar on earth. There was something he needed to say before he died. The Pope had summoned all of Italy's bishops, there were about 350 bishops in Italy at the time, to St. Peter's for a very important 10th anniversary celebration that was scheduled for February 11th, 1939. Some of you may recall that the famous Lateran Accords, which finalized peace between the Italian state and the Vatican, was signed on February 11th, 1929 in St. John Lateran Basilica in Rome. So he had called all the bishops to mark the 10th anniversary, not just the bishops, but the son of the king, the heir to the throne of Italy, many of the major political leaders, all of the foreign ambassadors to the Holy See, the world's press would all be present for this historic speech. Mussolini and the Pope had made a deal. They both came to power in 1922. The Pope became Pope early in 1922 as a kind of unexpected choice. He had only been cardinal for less than a year. There had been a big battle at the conclave among the cardinals in early 1922. It was a battle between, you might call them, the moderates and the conservatives or the right wing. Neither side had prevailed. Neither side had been able to get a two-thirds majority. And so eventually they turned, after many ballots, to a compromise choice, this recent cardinal from Milan, Achille Ratti. You see here a picture back in 1922 of the Pope and Mussolini. Mussolini, later in 1922, had come to power, 39 years old. He was the youngest prime minister Italy had ever seen. He was the leader of a violent group of fascists. They only had 35 members of parliament, but 20,000 fascists in a ragtag army had marched on Rome, the famous March on Rome, and pressured the Pope to appoint their leader, Benito Mussolini, as the new prime minister, and had happened. The Pope, as now if we get back to the scene in 1939, thinking back on all this, had in mind some more recent developments. He had made this agreement with Mussolini that he thought had benefited the church. We'll talk more about this in a minute. But in recent years, he'd been having growing doubts about the deal he had made. And the doubts had a lot to do with Mussolini's increasing embrace of the Nazi leader Adolf Hitler, a man Pope Pius XI despised. The Pope, as he sat at his desk that evening in early 1939, thought back with horror to events back in the spring when Mussolini had received Hitler in triumphal procession through the streets of Rome. And you saw the glorification of the Nazi leader, swastikas, the red Nazi flag flying everywhere in Rome. The Pope had fled Rome at the time, had gone to his summer home in Castel Gandolfo, closed the Vatican museums, literally turned off the lights of the Vatican so that Hitler could not come. Now, as the Pope sat at his desk, thinking he had a message, he had to get out to the Italian people before he died. It was with this in mind. This and the fact that shortly after Hitler's visit, Mussolini shocked the world by announcing the new racial policy of fascist Italy, the anti-Semitic laws that would shortly follow, the ideology that Italians were members of a pure, separate Italian race, and Italy's Jews, who had been there for over 2,000 years, were members of a foreign, noxious, dangerous race of mankind that needed, that good Christian society needed to be protected from. With the announcement of the racial policy, which made so clear that Mussolini was embracing Hitler, the Pope lashed out in a speech and asked, why was it that Mussolini felt the need to go and imitate Hitler? This enraged Mussolini because nothing made him angrier than being referred to as the stooge of Hitler. He saw himself as the big brother. Hitler had idolized him as a young man. In the 1920s, Hitler kept a large statue of Mussolini in his Munich office. So being called the stooge of Hitler just got the temper of Mussolini to a boiling point. And in fact, Mussolini began to rage against the Pope when he heard of the Pope's criticisms as he was trying to usher in his anti-Semitic and new racial policy. He said to his lover of the time, and if we get a chance, we could talk a little bit about this. Mussolini had many lovers, also many illegitimate children. He said, but his lover at the time, she had one very good quality other than her other attractions, she kept a diary. She kept a diary of over 1,000 pages a year, recording everything that Mussolini ever said to her. Recorded some of their other activities that were nonverbal as well, but we won't discuss those tonight. Mussolini said to her, hearing about the criticism that the Pope was making of him, if Italians still go to Mass, Mussolini said, it's only because I tell them to go to Mass. If Italians were left to their own devices, anti-clerics would be running through the streets, terrorizing priests, burning down churches. if there's a cross, a crucifix on the wall of every classroom in Italy, on the wall of every courtroom in Italy, it's because I ordered it there. It was not there before my fascist dictatorship. If the church was being given millions and millions of lira every year to support its activities, the church had not previously been given that kind of money by the Italian government. It's because I ordered it. If the Catholic Church has become the official religion of state, it's all because I ordered it. Before me, there was the liberal government and separation of church and state. How dare the Pope, who has profited so much from our alliance, begin to lash out at me? Well, Pius XI stayed up late that night of January 31st working on the text of his remarks. He was absolutely resolute that he would live long enough to give this speech, although he realized that he might not live much longer. He wanted to be able to warn the bishops that fascist spies were everywhere. He wanted to be able to warn the bishops about Mussolini's embrace of Hitler and pagan racial ideology. But in the days remaining before February 11th, as the bishops of Italy were gathering in St. Peter's and in Rome, the Pope began to further lose strength. By February 8th, 3 days before the planned speech, the Pope was confined to bed, and in fact, worried that his voice might not be strong enough to be heard in St. Peter's, he ordered that the Vatican printing office make up 350 copies, printed copies of his address, which by now was completed, so that as the bishops all arrived for the anniversary event, they would each be given a copy of his remarks, lest they not be able to hear them. February 10th, early morning hours, the day before the historic speech, the Pope further loses strength. His attendants, seeing him struggle breathing, put an oxygen mask over his face, being careful not to displace the white skull cap on his head. At 4 a.m., alarmed by his condition, they call in the number two person in the Vatican, his Cardinal Secretary of State, Eugenio Pacelli, who comes and sits kneels on his knees at the side of the Pope's bed, and seeing him struggling, tears come to the Cardinal's eyes. And it was shortly thereafter that the Pope took his last breath. He did not have his last wish, his last prayer to God answered. He did not live long enough to give that address. Across the Tiber, Mussolini heard the news of the Pope's death greeted it with a grunt of relief, seemed to be most concerned that the ritual requirements of him with the funeral and so on might interfere with his next planned coupling with his young mistress, Clara Petacci. But there was one thing, and we know this from the fascist archives, that he was very worried about. And I'll just say parenthetically here, my study was made possible in part by the recent opening of the Vatican archives for these fateful years, the 1920s and 30s. But also importantly, the fascist archives are crucial to understand this history. And not least because Mussolini had a whole army of informants, we might call them spies in the Vatican, who were providing extremely valuable reports to him on what was really going on behind the scenes in the Vatican. And one of the things he was learning in the days leading up to the planned anniversary celebration was that the Pope planned to give a speech denouncing him, denouncing fascism, and denouncing in particular the fascist embrace of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. He was beside himself because why? It was going to be difficult enough, he thought, to get the Italians to go along with his planned embrace of the Nazis. They had, after all, just recently fought a war against the Germans, World War I, in which 500,000 Italians were killed. Plus, Hitler's much vaunted racial supremacy of the Aryan race did not go down very well in Italy, most Italians realizing that Aryan race did not include them. So how it was, he realized this was not going to be easy, yet Mussolini was determined by this point to throw his fate in and Italy's fate in with the Nazis. So having the Pope speak out was already a major worry. The idea that now the Pope's voice from the tomb, essentially, might come and be heard after his death, therefore being even more powerful, had him extremely nervous. What did he do? He thought he had someone who could help him, someone who had in the past helped his cause. He turned to the man who is now in charge of the Vatican in the absence of the Pope, the Chamberlain, the Cardinal Secretary of State, Eugenio Pacelli, and through his ambassador to the Holy See, Mussolini called on Pacelli to, having heard that copies of the speech were made, to have all the copies destroyed. Eugenio Pacelli sent an order to the Vatican printing office to take all 350 copies of the speech and have them shredded. 3 weeks later, there would be a large crowd gathered in St. Peter's Square, looking to the chimney from the Apostolic Palace, waiting for the white smoke to waft up and show that a new pope had been elected. And in fact, the afternoon of the very first day of the conclave, white smoke does waft up, and from onto the loggia overlooking St. Peter's Square from St. Peter's Church, the cardinal deacon first strides out, announces, Habemus Papam, we have a pope, and then out in newly dressed in his papal white robe, the bejeweled tiara on his head, the tall, thin, bespectacled figure of Eugenio Pacelli comes out and is pronounced the new pope, Pius XII. Well, this is the scene with which I begin my book, and I think, in a way, introduces many of the themes of the book and what I learned through these newly available archives and their thousands of documents. But let me turn back again to the beginning of the story in 1922. The Pope was, at that time, a very vigorous man, the mountaineer Pope. In fact, the cardinals quickly grew to fear him, fear having to please him because he was known to have very exacting standards. And when he got angry at you, he was prone to bang his fist repeatedly on his table and shout at the top of his lungs. So we have all these accounts of cardinals actually going into their private chapel, getting on their knees and begging God for help that when they go see the Pope, he not find them wanting in some ways. The Pope was also a man, just to give you an idea of his personality, who had a very highly developed sense of the dignity of the papal office. These issues have come up recently with Pope Francis, who takes a different position from Pius XI. So that, to give you an idea, Pius XI insisted that his brother and sister, to whom he had been very close, now when they met him, which they could only do now through an appointment, through his secretary, addressed him as Your Holiness. He also believed it undignified for the Pope ever to share a meal with anyone else, not even a cardinal. And in the 17 years he was Pope, no one, including cardinals, ever got to sit at the table with him as he ate. The Pope's vision of society and of the church was a basically medieval vision. Of course, all this would change with the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s, but we're talking now about the 1920s and 30s. In this medieval vision, the church had a monopoly on divine truth, and it was a vision which was essentially authoritarian, had no sympathy for democracy, parliamentary government, and this sort of thing, which was seen as only interfering with the ability to make arrangements with governments which would allow the church to occupy its rightful position of supremacy in society and to guide people's behavior. 1922 is the year later when Mussolini comes to power. Of course, Mussolini is a very different type. He's a rabble-rouser. Get an idea there. He, as I mentioned, is fierce anti-cleric. By background, he was the leader of the left wing of the Socialist Party up through the outbreak of World War I. In fact, at the outbreak of World War I, he was the editor of the National Socialist Party newspaper, Avanti. He had a break with the Socialist Party because he favored intervention of Italy in the war. The official position of the Socialist Party was that the war was simply something promulgated by the bourgeoisie in which the working class would be the cannon fodder. And so Mussolini was ejected from the Socialist Party, fired from his position as editor of the paper, and quickly founds his own movement, which in 1919 formalizes as the fascist movement, soon to become the fascist party. As I mentioned, Mussolini had been an anti-cleric. In fact, when he founds the fascist movement, it initially also is anti-clerical. But Mussolini was nothing if not an opportunist. And as he looked at what would allow him to come to power, he realized that one of the main obstacles was the largest non-socialist party. Of course, the Socialist Party was the enemy, so that was his whole rationale, was to keep the Socialist Party from power. The largest other party was the Catholic Party, backed by the clergy of Italy, headed by a priest called the Popular Party, the Italian Popular Party. He thought if he could get the Pope to withdraw church support from the Popular Party, this would immeasurably ease his ability to come to power and to stay in power. He also had another problem, which was kind of an image problem. Because the fascists were known for their violence, that had been, for the last few years, terrorizing the population, particularly socialists, but others as well, murdering people, coming to power only through this kind of extortion of the king with this march on Rome. He needed some international legitimation that he thought the Pope could best provide. Now, if this was the reason why Mussolini wanted the Pope's support, you might ask, well, why would the Pope turn to a man like Mussolini to make an alliance with? The Pope had no illusions about Mussolini being a religious man. He knew Mussolini had not a religious bone in his body. But the Pope would tell those who asked that the Lord works in strange ways, that sometimes God chooses unlikely, implausible instruments for doing his will. And this is what he saw, an opportunity after decades in which there had been hostility between the Vatican and the Italian state to change all this. Let me just open a historical parenthesis here. As many of you, I'm sure, here know, but perhaps I need to remind some, Italy is a recent invention. The Italian kingdom was only pronounced in 1861. Before that, the Italian peninsula was just a patchwork of duchies, kingdoms, and one of the most important of these was the Papal States under the Pope's rule. These stretch from Rome, which was its capital, up through Ferrara, Bologna, and the north-central part of the Italian peninsula. So the unification of Italy took place as literally as a war against the papacy, against the Pope, against the Papal States. The last part of this was when the Italian army only in 1870 broke through the walls of Rome and took Rome from the Pope. The Pope retreats, then Pius IX retreats to the Vatican, proclaims himself a prisoner of the Vatican, excommunicates the king, excommunicates the prime minister, and tells Catholics of Italy not to recognize the legitimacy of the Italian state, which translates into, among other things, do not vote in parliamentary elections, do not run as candidates, we cannot recognize the legitimacy of Italy. The newly pronounced separation of church and state, freedom of religion, freedom of association, all these are vilified by the Pope at the time, who also, by the way, it's at this time that papal infallibility is pronounced for the first time, 1869, 1870. So this is all a defensive posture of the church in dealing with its newly displaced status. As the Pope is no longer a king as well as a pope, no longer a ruler of the papal states. So this is the tension that has existed now for decades. Mussolini, not coming from the liberal tradition, is something noted by the Pope in one of his public addresses, is the person the Pope thinks who can put an end to the secondary position of the church as he sees it in the Italian state, restore the church to its rightful central position in the state, and have a government and a police force in a position to enforce Catholic morality and to be sure that the papacy and the church is treated with the respect which it deserves in the Pope's view. Now, in reconstructing this strange alliance that developed, and I won't go into the details here, obviously, this is what the book deals with, how they make their alliance, beginning in the very first months in which Mussolini's in power, how Mussolini calls on the Pope to withdraw church support from the Catholic Party headed by the priest, which the Pope does, how in 1924, when Mussolini was absolutely certain he was going to fall because of scandal over the fascist murder of the leader of the opposition, how at all these times the Pope steps in to see Mussolini through and help him usher in his dictatorship, which he does in 1925, 1926. One of the things I discovered in these newly available archives is there was a semi-secret intermediary between shuttling between the Pope and Mussolini virtually every month. This is the man, the Jesuit Pietro Tacchi Venturi, a Roman Jesuit. He is selected early in 1923 for this role. He would meet one-on-one, alone with Mussolini, over 100 times in these years. No one met that often with Mussolini one-on-one other than his own inner fascist circle. He was a very curious personality, a very powerful one. And among other things, I discovered that he had begun signing his regular notes to Mussolini, "You're a loyal fascist," which, being the Pope's emissary to Mussolini, was rather striking. And in fact, there were those in the Vatican who suspected Tacchi Venturi of being a kind of double agent, that is, more working to represent fascism and Mussolini with the Pope than vice versa. Now, let me just give you, I want to give you some feel for the tensions in the Vatican in these later years when the Pope begins to have doubts about Mussolini. Before I do that, I'll just say very briefly, what did the Pope ask Tacchi Venturi, this Jesuit, to meet with Mussolini about? He brought a series of requests that only Mussolini could accommodate and which the previous regime would not accommodate for the church. For example, the Pope was very concerned about what he took to be the threat of Protestantism in Italy, the spread of Protestantism. And so he called on Mussolini to shut down the Protestant publications that were being distributed, shut down the meetings of Protestants at which they were proselytizing, things that Mussolini wasn't particularly interested in, but in order to please the Pope, he did. Give you a more trivial example, perhaps. The Pope was very concerned about immodest female clothing, including bathing suits and evening wear and so forth, and kept calling on Mussolini to take action against it. Now, if you know anything about Mussolini, you know this was not high on his list of priorities. And yet, and this is why I found so interesting, I could give many other examples of these kinds of requests the Pope made of Mussolini and how time and again, often begrudgingly, Mussolini would go along to keep the Pope happy, keep this alliance going. But as I mentioned, there comes a time, particularly because of the increasing embrace by the mid-30s and then, of course, gathering steam in the late 30s of Mussolini with Hitler, that the Pope is having second thoughts. At this time, and one of the things that we only know now because of the opening of these both because of the opening of the Vatican archives put together with the fascist spy archives, which are in the state archives in Rome, so we can kind of triangulate documents around the same events and same people, we see what's going on, which is, I'll give you one example. In summer of 1935, Mussolini makes known his intention to invade Ethiopia. He wants to recreate the great Roman Empire. The world is aghast. The League of Nations threatens a boycott if they go ahead with the war. And the Pope, speaking to an audience that happens to be in Italy at the time, this was an international meeting of nurses, so it had absolutely nothing to do with Ethiopia, he, in unscripted remarks, says, this is just a month basically before the invasion, that such a war would be an unjust war, it would be unspeakably horrible. These are the words of the Pope. The men around the Pope in Secretary of State Eugenio Pacelli's office are aghast. If this word gets out, they know that Mussolini is absolutely, you know, hell-bent on this war, and it means everything to him at the time. To have the Pope quoted as being opposed to an invasion would undo everything. In fact, they would rely very heavily on the Catholic clergy in Italy to drum up popular support for the Ethiopian war. And what do? Well, the text of the Pope's remarks is supposed to be published the next day in the Vatican Daily newspaper. The men in the Secretary of State office go to work that evening. And amazingly, we have a diary from the one of the high-up prelates in the Secretary of State office who described what they did. He said, that evening, and I'm quoting from him, he performed a, quote, surgical operation, unquote. Quote, here I cut a word, there I add another. Here I modify a sentence, there I erase another, unquote. What would be published the next day in the Vatican newspaper bore none of the criticism of the intended invasion of Ethiopia. And we find a variety of examples of this kind. Now, in 1938, in July, a new racial policy is announced, I described earlier, in which Jews are regarded as a noxious, dangerous foreign race. And this will be followed shortly thereafter in September, beginning in September, with a series of anti-Semitic laws, the so-called racial laws. They're represented here in one of the fascist anti-Semitic publications, which shows that all the Jewish children are thrown out of school, all the Jewish teachers are fired, all the Jewish civil servants are thrown out of work, as are all Jewish members of the military, and so on and so forth. The Pope is unhappy about this, not least because it's the latest sign that Mussolini is embracing the racial, pagan racial ideology of Hitler. Yet again, the people around him are worried that the Pope is going to ruin their alliance with Mussolini and with Italian fascism. So again, what we can now discover through the, not just Vatican archives, but archives in the Italian diplomatic service and other fascist archives, is how the Mussolini's agents worked together with high prelates, including, for example, the world head of the Jesuit order, including Eugenio Pacelli, the Cardinal Secretary of State, to prevent the Pope from speaking out against the racial laws. And we know, just give you one example of this, the Mussolini's ambassador to the Holy See, when given the task from Mussolini to do what he could to stop the Pope from speaking out, says he knows the person who could most help. It's the superior general of the Jesuit order, the man who'd been head of the Jesuits worldwide since 1915, a Pole named Ledochowski. And he says he can help, and these are the words of Mussolini's ambassador to the Holy See, he's the man to help us because of his, quote, implacable loathing for the Jews, unquote. And at this meeting, and we have here the Mussolini's ambassador's detailed account of his meeting with the Jesuit head says, you know, Eugenio Pacelli and I are at wit's end. We're doing everything we can to stop the Pope from speaking out, but the Pope seems to be out of control now in his old age. In fact, he's becoming senile and doesn't apparently realize what he's saying. Something, the Jesuit head says, has to be done. Well, I don't want to go on too long because I want to leave plenty of time for questions. But what we find is something really, at least for me, was unexpected. A battle within the Vatican at the highest levels, a battle to keep the alliance between the Vatican and fascism intact, and a battle that would be waged in part against the ailing, elderly, but determined Pope, Pius XI. Pius XI, just conclude on this note, from my point of view, is a tragic figure. I think I mentioned earlier that he had a medieval vision of the church, and I think what happened in his last years is he began to realize that that medieval vision was not adequate to equip him to deal with the threats that were newly appearing in Europe as fascism was spreading, first with in Italy with Mussolini, and then, of course, with Hitler in Germany, and that a new approach to the church and to the world was required in the Vatican at the same time as those around him did not share this view. Also, a rampant anti-Semitism in the church was another factor, so that the anti-Semitic racial laws were not a problem from the point of view of most of the hierarchy of the church at the time. In fact, one of the things I've discovered is that if you look at how the fascist regime tried to get the Italians to agree to the anti-Semitic policies, it was by quoting various of the church publications which warned of the dangers that Jews posed to healthy Christian society. So what happened was that this kind of strange couple, odd couple, this sort of marriage between these two very different people, between the Pope, the devout scholarly Pope, and the violent bully fascist Mussolini, it was a marriage which did not end well. In the end, as I've discussed, the Pope thought Mussolini was someone who had begun to feel he was a kind of god himself, and therefore dangerously bordering on a pagan religion. Mussolini, for his part, began to rage against Pius XI and, in fact, told his fellow fascist bigwigs, Pius XI, he said, is a disaster for the church. Mussolini, you wouldn't think, be a man to give advice to the church, but he felt no compunction about doing so. This was the story, the sad story, but the dramatic story of Mussolini and the Pope. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they are listening to David Kurtzer speaking about his book, The Pope and Mussolini, and it's time for questions.
Hi, I have actually three questions, but I think they can all be answered yes or no. Were there any copies of the Pope's speech that remained, or were they all destroyed? Did the Pope indicate any concerns with fascism as far as the economic system that it was? And the third question, what was the Pope Jesuit also? No,
the first Jesuit Pope is Francis, the current Pope. So okay. He was not so the Pope was not Jesuit, although Jesuits were among his top advisors, and so they figure prominently in my book. First question, there was a version of the speech that did survive. So as I mentioned, Eugenio Pacelli, Cardinal Pacelli, ordered the destruction of all 350 copies that were printed up to be given the bishops. They were never given the bishop. They were destroyed. He did not, though, destroy the original text that the Pope so laboriously had written out on these pages that I described at the beginning of my remarks. He buried them, though. So they would only see the light of day, begin to see the light of day after his death. So he becomes Pope Pius XII in March of 1939. He himself is Pope till his death in 1958. He's succeeded by John the 23rd, who would change everything in the church with the Second Vatican Council, including end the demonization of the Jews. And Pope John the 23rd began to release parts of the speech, but it would only be fully known to us with the opening of these archives in 2006. So in case anybody's interested in what the speech said, although you just asked for a yes or no answer, so I don't know. The speech is not quite the ringing denunciation that Mussolini feared, but it was critical. It was certainly a speech Mussolini would not have liked to had made by the Pope, much less in that very dramatic kind of circumstance. It was a speech which did warn the bishops that fascist spies were everywhere. It did warn Italians not to embrace Nazism and Nazi racial ideology. So this, in very brief, is what the speech was like. Finally, the economic policies. The church wasn't particularly interested in the economic policies of the fascist regime. And what it was interested in was saving the banks that were close to the Vatican. One of the things that Mussolini did early on in the 1920s to ingratiate himself with the Pope was to save the bankrupt Bank of Rome, which was very close to the Vatican. So there is some economic relationship there.
It It seems that Pius XI died rather conveniently. Is there any evidence that he was murdered?
Yes, that's an interesting question. In fact, when I first began to work on this, I was sitting at a dinner next to a Roman countess. They still have countesses in Rome. And she asked what I was working on. I said, I'm working on Pius XI. And she said, oh, he was murdered. It was the first thing she said. And about every 2 years or so in Italy, one of the major newspapers has a story that, you know, new evidence that Pius XI was actually murdered. Now, the basic theory of the murder is like this. We know Mussolini was very worried about the speech. He didn't want the Pope to live long enough. The Pope had a personal physician, Dr. Milani, who, however, was sick himself in bed the week before the Pope died. So the Pope could not be attended when he grew ill in that period by his own doctor. The senior physician in the Vatican, his last name was Petacci. Anybody recognize that name? Clara Petacci, the young mistress of Mussolini at the time, was his daughter. Moreover, Clara's brother was this corrupt wheeler-dealer who was using his sister's relationship with Mussolini to enrich himself in various ways. So according to this theory, the father could have been the subject of a kind of extortion. And then in any case, the Pope was in bad shape. You know, just help him anticipate the date of his passing to the next world by a few days. So this would be the theory. The problem with the theory is there's no evidence to support it. So timing makes one skeptical, perhaps, but there is no evidence that he actually was killed.
Did you have access to the 1,000-page journals that the mistress kept? Or?
Well, luckily, a lot of these are now published, particularly from my period. Now, she was his mistress to the last days. In fact, many of you may remember the scene of Mussolini after he is executed, being hung by his feet from a scaffolding in Milan. It's a terrifying kind of image. Right next to him is a woman, and that's Clara Petacci. So she's with him to the last, his last day. And so a lot of the diaries and she only began to be his mistress in 1936. So of the thousands and thousands of pages, the ones that are directly relevant to me have to do with the very first years. And a lot of that has now been published, obviously, in Italian. So that makes it much easier to consult. However, the originals are now in the State Archive in Rome and can be seen by historians.
Hi, good evening. I've always thought, well, let me say this. Did the existence of Lenin and Joseph Stalin have anything to do with the positions these popes have taken? Because I've always thought that any pope during those eras would look to his left and see godless Marxism there, look to the right and he's got the fascists, and he'd figure he's on a tightrope to try to save the lives of his priests and his ministry.
Right. Now, I'm glad you brought that up. Certainly, again, if you think 1922, when this fateful relationship begins, it's only 5 years after the Bolshevik Revolution. Much of Europe is terrified, including the church, for obvious reasons, given the anti-clerical nature of Bolshevism, is terrified that this revolution is going to spread. And, of course, the communist movement does spread well beyond Russia. And, this here, too, we get into the church relationship with Hitler later on, that first Mussolini and then, to some extent, Hitler are seen as the, like them or not, the best bets for keeping the communists at bay. At least, this was the fear and this was the argument. So, however, I would say at that time, there was no comparison made by the church of communism and fascism. Fascism, the worry about fascism is actually not that it was of the right, but that it was of the left. That there was a left wing, at least from the church point of view, of fascism, which was still anti-clerical, insofar as fascism favored the establishment of the Catholic Church as the official state religion and gave positions of honor to the priests, had, for example, in making practically every young person join a fascist youth group, having a priest affiliated with each local chapter of that fascist youth group. All this was seen as a positive development by most in the church at the time. Although there was a wing of the church, largely identified with that earlier popular party I mentioned, who was very unhappy about the Pope making the deal with Mussolini, very critical, and warned, I think presciently, that long-term this could damage the moral standing of the church. So within the Catholic population of Italy, there were certainly those who were not happy about this deal with the fascists.
That was fascinating. Could you talk a little bit more about the Lateran Accords? What were some of the key provisions? And also, are any of those provisions still in force?
Yes. So the Lateran Accords, remember, talked about this hostility that had existed for decades between the Vatican, the Church, and the Italian government. Mussolini entered into negotiations with the Pope through an intermediary, which lasted a number of years and would come to fruition in early 1929. The Lateran Accords had three parts. One was just an economic agreement that for taking away the papal states, the Italian state would make a large payment to the Vatican. That's the least important of the three parts. The two major parts, the first is the actual treaty which establishes Vatican City. Before this Lateran Accord, Vatican City did not exist as a legal entity, did not exist as a sovereign nation that it subsequently became. So this is all established in the first part. The second part is the Concordat, which would govern the relationship between the Italian state and the church, and would give a variety of benefits to the church. For example, it extended the mandatory teaching of religion to secondary school. It forbade ex-priests from teaching in public schools, something that the Pope was unhappy that in the liberal Italy, if a man left the priesthood, he could get a job teaching. Often in a rural village, he might be one of the few literate people, and one of the few jobs he could get as an ex-priest would be teaching in the school. There's a provision in the Concordat that forbade such people ever to be hired by the school systems of Italy. So there are a whole variety of, you can actually, I think, online, you know, find the document. What's interesting is right after the war, and you know, what happens to the Lateran Accords? They're drawing up a new Republican constitution. There's no longer the king's been discredited, so they do away with the monarchy. And there's a big debate over whether this deal worked out with Mussolini should be part of the post-war democratic constitution of Italy. Surprisingly, the Communist Party, which is the second largest party at the time after the Catholic Christian Democratic Party, votes with the Christian Democrats and against a variety of other more lay parties to incorporate this deal in the post-war constitution. And so although in the 1980s, it had been modified somewhat, but it still governs a relationship between church and state in Italy.
More questions?
This is off topic a bit, but could you talk about Pope Francis and any impressions you have of him?
Yes, well, I'm certainly not an expert on Pope Francis. I would just say, well, what advice might I give Pope Francis based on what I know of Pius XI, if I should be so bold as do that? And I think one thing that I think Pope Francis should be concerned about is that as a relatively young, he's not all that young, he's, what, 77 or something like that, but vigorous, still a vigorous man, he's able to do things that as he gets older and older, he may not be able to do. And with many popes, of course, Benedict XVI is unusual in having stepped down, but insofar as popes are pope like John Paul II till their dying breath, often in the last few years, and it was certainly true of John Paul II, a very vigorous, dynamic pope, but in his last years, he was unable really to function as leader of the church. People around him not only had to cover for him, but there was a vacuum of power into which others around him rushed. And in fact, something similar happened with Benedict XVI. Causing some of the recent problems in the Vatican. So one of the things I would suggest is, you know, if he really wants to make changes in the church, not to wait very much longer. The other thing I think that these newly opened archives suggest about popes is, you know, beware of the people around you. So, and, you know, Francis has rather dramatically castigated the curia for what he called careerism, and for seeking power for the sake of power and so forth. So he has shown remarkable concern about some of these same issues.
Could you say something about the authoritarianism of both the Pius the 11th and Mussolini, that this is where they connected?
Well, yeah, so it's in a way where they connected, but of course this also kept them apart. Both what they had in common is when people went to meet with the Pope, they would often be fearful of a tirade that would castigate them and reduce them to kind of quivering mass of jelly. But the Pope, of course, was someone who believed that the church was totalitarian. That, in fact, he said this in a speech. Yes, there's one true totalitarian organization in the world, but it's not the fascist party. It's the Roman Catholic Church. And so, you know, when you talk about these two very strong authoritarian people, this, rather than bring them together in a way, it also was the nub of the disagreement between them, because the Pope certainly could never be happy with the cult of the Duce, for example. One of the things that concerned him I didn't get to talk about, but increasingly in the 1930s, Mussolini was creating this glorification of himself. Throughout Italy, you'd have written on the sides of barns and houses, Mussolini is always right, and other such slogans. And the Pope grew increasingly concerned about this as well. In fact, sent when the Italian ambassador to the Holy See came to meet with him one day, the Pope said, could you give a personal, confidential message to Mussolini for me? And the ambassador was kind of horrified, dumbstruck, what kind of such message, but said, yes, he would. And the message was, the Pope said, warn Mussolini that if he's trying to represent himself as a kind of semi-divinity himself, it's not going to end well for him. And if you think of that picture of Mussolini hung by the feet, the Pope knew what he was talking about there. Yes?
I've got another question about the current Pope. I've read that he's going to take a trip to the Middle East in the spring, and he's not just visiting. He's supposed to be on some kind of a peace mission. Mm-hmm. Do you see anything coming out of that, given your background?
It's very difficult, of course, given how the situation with the political situation in the Middle East, that anyone, whether Pope, President, and so on, can, with one trip, make much of a difference. Certainly one of the things that the Pope is most concerned about is the state of Christian communities in the Middle East. And this is, of course, the relationship with the Jewish community in Israel gets a lot of attention. But from the Pope's point of view, certainly he's very concerned about many embattled Christian communities in the Middle East. And so I'm sure this will be, you know, on his mind as he travels there. I think from Israel's point of view, in terms of now trying to say something from the perspective of this earlier history, there's still a kind of thorn in the side of relationship between the Vatican and the Jewish community, which comes out in Israel in various ways, which has to do with the failure to recognize church responsibility for the demonization of the Jews. Now, back in the 20s and 30s and earlier, again, of course, no pope, no church agency ever foresaw the mass murder of the Jews, nor ever countenanced it, wanted it in any way, and so forth. But when one asks the question, how is it that millions of Europeans in the middle of the 20th century could be willing to countenance, and in fact, in case of many hundreds of thousands or more, directly participate in the mass murder of Europe's Jews, including babies, you have to ask, how did Jews become so demonized? And there are, of course, a number of sources. The Roman Catholic Church is far from the only one, but the church does bear, I think, from earlier work I've done, responsibility that hasn't been confronted. So if you're talking about the relationships with Israel, I think one thing Francis could do is, like some national churches, such as the National Church in France, come to real terms with this history. After all, with the Second Vatican Council, the church turned dramatically a new leaf. So we're not talking about the present church. We're talking about a legacy.
I know that this is the Pope after that, but there's the Pius XII, who you mentioned. Now it comes into power in 1939 as the new Pope. Is any of those archives about what happened during World War II available, or is that still under wraps?
Well, as many people know, there's been great controversy about Pope Pius XII and his alleged silence during the Holocaust. And so there's been a lot of pressure to open the archives, particularly for the war period. So far, they haven't been opened. However, some papers have been made available. A number of years ago, some of you may recall, in 1960 or so, there was a play called The Deputy, which represented Pius XII during the war in very negative terms as turning a blind eye to the mass murder of the Jews of Europe, not ever protesting, and so forth. That led the Vatican to have a group of Jesuits prepare 12 volumes of documents, which are basically correspondence between bishops and nuncios in occupied Europe and the Vatican. And those are quite helpful, but it's just a small fraction of the documentation. So we don't have those documents open. I do think, though, that if you want to understand the man who becomes the pope, in a way, those records during the war will be less revealing than the records I've got to see when he's the number two man, the Secretary of State, because he keeps a diary throughout these years that we now have. He is engaged in a huge correspondence with the diplomats, not just correspondence, but he meets weekly with all the foreign ambassadors, the Holy See, who write their own accounts of what he said to them as these dramatic developments occur through the 1930s. And so, you know, in my book, I try to, get at what kind of man Eugenio Pacelli was and how was he acting with respect to the fascists, with respect to the Nazis, and so on. And so, that said, obviously, it'll be good when those archives are finally open and we see what we can find out for the period of the Second World War.
Any other questions? Great. So in your research that you just said here, there's those 12 volumes that were released in response. Was there a lot of correspondence from the occupied part of Europe of different individual Catholic bishops and everything helping, hurting, hindering, or is there a wide variety of reactions?
Well, I think for the World War II period, there's a lot of controversy about this, about those who defend the silence of Pius XII during the war say that if he had spoken out publicly, things would have been worse for the Jews. Of course, 90% of them were murdered, as it was. But and there are bishops and others who were quoted as begging during the early 40s, begging the Pope to speak out. So there was, even within the church, disagreement about this policy of public silence during the Holocaust. One of the things I discovered in my research, and is part of my book, is that when Pius XI dies, I mentioned how relieved Mussolini was, I found that Mussolini's ambassador to the Holy See begins to work actively to ensure that the successor to Pius XI is a man who will not be hostile to Mussolini, not be hostile to fascism, and try to make peace with the Hitler's regime as well. And so what I found and what's documented in the book is how the Italian ambassador, partly working with the German, the Nazi ambassador to the Holy See, lobby the cardinals to try to elect a man they believe will change the kind of critical policy that Pius XI had toward Nazis and toward Italian fascism and the racial campaign. And they lobby for Eugenio Pacelli to become the new pope. And of course, he does.
During the same period of time, say 39 to 43, when there was some evidence of the massacres, but not a lot of hard evidence, the United States government and the British government didn't say anything out loud either, did they, during that time?
Well, okay, this is beyond my period of history. Right. I don't think it's true that they didn't say anything. I think they did protest. But need to get a World War II historian to document what happens there.
Comment over here.
Yes, I was curious. What was the number of the Jewish population in Italy at that time, and were they mostly concentrated in Rome, or were they throughout the different provinces that had united? And what was the number of the Jewish people who were sent to the camps, and which camps were they sent to?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I probably should have said this. There were, the Jewish population of Italy is very small. It's ancient, 2,000 years old, but very small. Nothing like, for example, Poland. Poland, 10% of the Polish population was Jewish. Italy is 0.1%. So of 35 million Italians at the time, about 35,000 were Jews, Italian Jews. Actually, by the late 30s, a number of Jewish refugees from Germany and so on had made their way to the relative safety of Italy, so there were about another 10,000 Jews in Italy when the racial laws were proclaimed, so a total of 45,000. Of those, the number who were murdered, and largely they were, almost all of them were murdered in Auschwitz, is estimated to be something between 7,000 and 8,000. So most of the Jews in Italy, unlike some other parts of Europe, survived, but of course a large number, including many pillars of the Jewish community, many of the rabbis of Italy, were murdered in Auschwitz. And I might just add that Pius XI, I think, made a distinction between the Jews of Italy and Jews elsewhere, like Poland. He had spent some time in Poland at the end of World War I. And for him, unlike a number of the people around him I discuss in the book, the Jews of Italy were not a problem. He didn't see them as a threat. What he didn't know is that the envoy he had been sending to Mussolini all those years, the Jesuit Tacchi Venturi meeting monthly on the Pope's behalf with Mussolini, was from the mid-1920s, warning Mussolini about the Jewish threat in Italy and that he should take action against Italy's Jews.
Cornwell's book on Hitler's Pope, well, that was written before these recent archives came out.
And yes, yes.
What's your feeling about that story or whether that will be in hand?
Right. Well, so John Cornwell, many people know his best-selling book, Hitler's Pope, which I think came out around 2000, so over a dozen years ago, well before these archives were opened. Well, I think his title, first of all, is unfortunate. He might admit to that now, too. I mean, Bocelli, for all his failings, was not Hitler's Pope. He was certainly no Nazi. He thought he was acting on the best interest, in the best interest of the church. But I think, you know, Cornwell had it right that Bocelli was willing to, and in fact eager to, deal with the Nazis as a way of, from his perspective, trying to protect the church in Germany. And so, for example, one of the first agreements, international agreements, Hitler makes after coming to power in January 1933 is with the Vatican, the Concordat between the Vatican and the new Nazi regime, which is signed in Eugenio Pacelli's Secretary of State office in the Vatican. And this was an agreement that was roundly criticized at the time by others. For example, the Austrian Prime Minister Dollfuss, who would be shortly thereafter assassinated by Nazis, loudly complained that by legitimating the Nazis and withdrawing church support from the church party in Germany, the center party, that this was opening the gates to the Nazi takeover of Austria, because Austria, of course, overwhelmingly Catholic country, previously been told that, no, the church cannot support, no good Catholic can support the Nazis. Now, all of a sudden, they're finding out something different. So even at the time, it was very controversial. And so this story that is painted there with the documents that were available at the time, in that sense, I think raises some very interesting and troubling points. Now, with the opening of these archives, I think we can understand all this much better.
That's a great way to end a very nuanced approach to a very difficult subject. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you for coming.